This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
There are hundreds of thousands of displaced people, including small children, are being forced to sleep out in the open at the mercy of the elements. People speak in horrifying details of attacks on their villages where men, boys are killed, women raped, homes pillaged, and schools along with other infrastructures are destroyed.
That was Babar Balogh, spokesman for the UN Refugee Agency on the deteriorating situation in Burkina Faso. Details coming up also. The World Health Organization stresses that social distancing is the most effective way to reduce the spread of the coronavirus. And increasing reports indicate African governments are seeking to control the flow of information as it relates to the coronavirus pandemic. These stories and more ahead on African News Tonight. But first, our top story. The World Health Organization stresses that social distancing is not only the best option to reduce coronavirus spread, but also the most effective one. However, in many African countries, social distancing can disrupt economic activities and deprive millions of workers of much-needed income, especially in informal economies. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi spoke with Joseph Siegel, director of research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, about how to ease rising unemployment rates and how the international community can help Africa counter the socioeconomic challenges from the pandemic.
Well, clearly, with high levels of poverty and a number of people living at the subsistence level, African countries don't have the economic buffer to lock down their economies for an extended period of time. So it's a particular challenge for Africa as it faces this pandemic. And as all countries we're seeing around the world, there's this tension between public health and the economy. And how do you provide that balance? All countries are struggling with this. And I think we're seeing the same thing within Africa. It's a more acute challenge in many African countries. And so there's going to have to be some unique adaptations within Africa. And to its benefit, Africa has a history of responding to infectious diseases and has more developed community health systems from this past experience. And so mobilizing those systems, I think, will be particularly important. But clearly, you know, in the short term, as you're trying to reduce mobility, there are going to need to be some interventions to try to make sure people have basic needs to live. Day to day, they need to have access to food and water. To the extent that emergency measures can be taken to try to increase access to those basic needs, especially for people in these high-density urban areas, and that can go a long way to reducing the mobility, reducing the acceleration of spread of the disease. And this may be the form of cash transfers to these communities, at households, some food vouchers, rent deferrals, some public kitchens, means trying to provide some short-term protections for individual households so that they don't feel compelled to continue to go about their day-to-day activities and in the process put themselves and the broader community at risk.
And UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres expressed his concern over African countries' capabilities to counter the pandemic and called for international solidarity with poor and undeveloped countries. How could the international community help the African continent?
I think this notion of solidarity is really important. I think this virus has shown that despite the many differences, you know, we are all one global community and we're facing a common threat with the COVID-19. I think here in the short term, international community can be of most help in trying to mobilize some of these short-term emergency measures to help meet basic needs of communities that are most at risk. And so there is this mandate to try to reduce movements of individuals to reduce the spread in Africa with large numbers of subsistence households, that's going to require some sort of subsidization or support for access to basic items like food, water, sanitation. And so mobilizing those sort of emergency safety nets, I think, is one way where the international community can provide some support. You know, there are other ideas on the table about trying to delay or defer some of the balance of payment stresses that African governments are facing. And if that can help mobilize an emergency response in the short term, I think that would be very impactful. I think over the medium and longer term, the pandemic could be going on for some time. And so the economic effects will be hard felt all around the world, and especially in Africa. And looking at some longer term structural support to help minimize that impact, and especially for helping to provide some support to small and medium sized businesses in Africa, will be really important to try to give some means of further resiliency to these livelihoods and to the broader economic realities that, that many African countries are facing.
That was VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawy speaking with Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at Africa Center for Strategic Studies. Increasing reports indicate that African governments are seeking to control the flow of information as it relates to the coronavirus pandemic, and the immediate targets are journalists. Angela Quintal, the Committee to Protect Journalists Africa Program Coordinator, says censoring journalists and cracking down on the media is not educating the public about the virus and is counterproductive. VOA Salem Salomon spoke to her recently, and here is an excerpt from their conversation.
You know, obviously information to the public is key, but what we have found is that governments are using a public health crisis to go further than actually educating the public, but using it, particularly those countries that are repressive, in using that to try and ensure that the public doesn't have a right to know. And in the process, what you're seeing is you're seeing legislation that is being used. And of course, you know, the catchphrase that everyone loves using, so-called fake news. We've seen laws and regulations that are being promulgated and enacted, including in South Africa, where the intention to publish false information about COVID-19 is a criminal offense. So South Africa is seeking to criminalize something that we have not seen in a democratic South Africa for years. Now, there are certainly people who would say that it is tightly defined and therefore isn't the threat that one would imagine. But the point is, it's on the statute books. It's there and it can be used. And it's also, I guess, it's also emboldened others, and others who might not necessarily have the constitutional restraints that that South Africa may have. So let's just look at Zimbabwe. You know, Zimbabwe just recently decided that to enact regulations where, and I speak under correction, but I do think that the penalty is 25 years in prison. It's incredibly broad, right? You've seen it elsewhere. I mean, I had journalists in Botswana contacting me to tell me about the new emergency law regulations that have been passed, and where things are pretty tough in terms of how the media will be able to report on this, and would in fact need pre-publication censorship. So before they publish anything, as I understand it, they would need permission in terms of the messaging. So we're seeing that across the continent. We're also seeing laws that are being used that are already on the statute books. So for example, in Kenya, we see the Cybercrime Act being used. We've seen the same in Tanzania. And then just taking it further, while some countries have ensured that journalists are seen as an essential service, so while they lock down the countries, journalists are able, certainly in the countries that have allowed journalists to function during this period, where there are lockdowns, what you do find is that messaging isn't actually getting down to the forces on the ground. So we have been dealing with many arrests of journalists because they're outside reporting, and the ordinary security agents on the street are not aware and are therefore are arresting them because they're saying that they're breaking the lockdown. It's of great grave concern because generally, you know, there is much else happening on the continent when it comes to media freedom. But we find time and time again on a daily basis, we've been swamped with, you know, reports of either journalists being arrested, journalists being harassed, photographs being deleted, anything to try and stop that messaging getting out, which, of course, for the Committee to Protect Journalists is problematical, because what the public does need, it needs credible, accurate information from credible sources. And obviously, journalists who are on the ground are providing that. What you don't want is the sort of misinformation that you see when people turn to WhatsApp and they are messaging their friends about things that bear no resemblance to what really is happening in terms of the fight against the pandemic. So again, journalists and public health officials should be working hand in hand to ensure that the right messages gets across, and censoring journalists is certainly not the way to do it.
That was Angela Quintal, the Committee to Protect Journalists Africa Program Coordinator, speaking to VOA's Salem Solomon. The UN Refugee Agency warns Burkina Faso is on the brink of a humanitarian disaster because of growing instability and a chronic shortage of resources. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Looming over this alarming humanitarian crisis is the COVID-19 pandemic. The World Health Organization reports Burkina Faso has the third largest outbreak of the disease in Africa, with 340 cases, including 19 deaths. The United Nations reports Burkina Faso has the world's fastest growing displacement crisis. Over the past 16 months, it finds nearly 840,000 people have fled their homes because of conflict and drought. Baba Balosh, spokesman for the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, says many lives are at risk because of the harsh desert-like conditions in remote parts of the country and mounting brutal attacks by militants against civilians.
There are hundreds of thousands of displaced people, including small children, are being forced to sleep out in the open at the mercy of the elements. People speak in horrifying details of attacks on their villages, where men, boys are killed, women raped, homes pillaged, and schools along with other infrastructures are destroyed.
The UNHCR warns it is in a race against time to prevent more human suffering. It estimates 350,000 people in remote areas urgently need shelter and water to help them cope with the dry desert heat. It says people live in a permanent state of fear as armed groups wreak havoc in the country's Centre Nord and Sahel regions. It says increased security has not deterred militants from attacking police and military, as well as civilians, schools, health centers, and other infrastructure. Balor says his agency is working with local authorities and other humanitarian organizations to rush shelter and other relief supplies to the displaced. However, he notes these life-saving operations are being hampered by rampant insecurity and a chronic lack of money, material, and staff. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Here is a recap of our top stories. The World Health Organization stresses that social distancing is the most effective way to reduce the spread of the coronavirus. And increasing reports indicate African governments are seeking to control the flow of information as it relates to the coronavirus pandemic. And for more news and information, visit our website at voanews.com. In the Gambia, police are busy fighting transnational food smuggling as the country faces the deadly coronavirus pandemic. They have seized a large consignment of foodstuffs that were being smuggled to neighboring Senegal and nearby Guinea-Bissau. Panderambai reports from Raleigh, North Carolina.
The Gambia State of Emergency Regulation has banned all export trade while the country tackles the deadly coronavirus pandemic. The country is trying to preserve its essential basic commodities to avoid the possibility of food shortages in the long term. But police spokesman Lamin Jai has told journalists there is some defiance of the ban.
Today we are here at the police anti-crime unit camp at Bijilo to report to the general public about the activities of certain individuals, something that is definitely a great concern to the Gambia police force. And we want the public also to be aware of so that they can support the police in the fight against this situation. And this is about the smuggling of essential commodities. As you can see, all these commodities have been intercepted from individuals who were about to smuggle these commodities out of the Gambian borders.
The West African nation has beefed up police street and border patrols to halt smuggling. They confiscated trucks that were filled with basic commodities bound for neighboring countries. The trucks have been impounded in Banjul. Some of the seized foodstuffs were also kept at the police anti-crime main base in Bijilo. The businessmen who have been linked to the food trafficking have been charged. Njai warned would-be food traffickers, they face arrest.
We are aware of the fact that the emergency powers have made it very clear that no one is supposed to export essential commodities out of the Gambia. And so this is very clear in the laws of the Gambia Emergency Powers Regulation 2020. But we have seen that some individuals are in the business of smuggling essential commodities out of the country.
He also appealed to the public to help the police with information so that illegal food exports can be stopped. He knows that people living around the border villages could play an important role toward exposing traffickers.
We want communities to help the police, inform the police at any point in time they see vehicles or boats that are destined to transport commodities outside of the country.
In a recent state address, President Adama Barrow said the country had enough food for the medium term. He has also warned against food hoarding and unreasonable increases in commodity prices. For VOA Africa, this is Pandering by reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
A year ago this week, tens of thousands of Sudanese protesters began a two-month-long peaceful sit-in in Khartoum that helped oust dictator Omar al-Bashir after 3 decades in power. Sudan's unprecedented uprising inspired popular protests around the world, but the Sudanese protesters themselves found inspiration through music. The Khartoum sit-in featured near-constant live music performances by Sudanese artists who used song to motivate their comrades. VOA's Jason Patinkin recorded hours of live music at the sit-in last year, and for the anniversary of Bashir's ouster, shares some of those tunes along with reflections from Sudanese bassist and radio host Islam El Bati about what it was like to perform during Sudan's revolution.
When Sudan's revolutionaries began what would become a historic two-month occupation of the streets around Khartoum's Gyada military headquarters last April, they pitched tents to sleep in, set up kitchens and health clinics to care for the tens of thousands of protesters, and erected barricades of brick and metal to defend against armed attacks from security forces. And then Sudan's revolutionaries played music from protest anthems like this to spontaneous drum circles to late night reggae revivals. Sudan's revolution was an explosion of music, testament to the creativity of the Sudanese people and a reminder of how stifled they were under former President Omar al-Bashir's dictatorship. For 3 decades, Bashir's government strictly limited concerts, banning political songs and songs about freedom. But at the sit-in, musicians could play what they wanted. Bassist and radio DJ Islam El-Bati performed at the revolution.
During the sit-in, it was live music every day. This was like the first time in the last 30 years where Sudanese people could sit in one place until 4 a.m. and listen to music. This is something to dream about before. I think it was the first time for a lot of people to be in a place where they could sing anything they want to sing and not be afraid.
The sit-in at Khartoum's Qiyada military headquarters brought all of Sudan's diverse people together, from Khartoum's elite to refugees from war-torn regions of Darfur, Nuba Mountains, and Blue Nile. There were Muslims and Christians, men and women, light-skinned and dark, young and old. And the music reflected this mix, with classical Sudanese orchestras, traditional tribal dances, hip-hop rap battles, and smooth jazz.
It was like a dream of what Sudan could be like, where we could have a place where everyone is there, everyone's playing, no one's clashing with the other. You know, we're all here, we all do different things, but we're here for one common purpose. So even the music sounded different. Even if it's the same song we'd play in another setting, it sounded absolutely different because of this energy and because of the fact that everyone was just there and everyone was in harmony.
But the most popular musical genre at the sit-in was reggae. Jamaican legend Bob Marley's calls for uprising and equality gave voice to the yearnings of the Sudanese revolutionaries.
I think because they can directly relate to what he's saying. It's political, but it's also very powerful. Everyone in Sudan knows the words to get up, stand up, or war.
El-Beti says music like this helped fuel the protests, even as gunmen attacked the sit-in and killed peaceful protesters.
It kept it alive. I think arts and culture in general kept the revolution alive. You know, aside from the fact that we had a goal that we would not stop until we achieved, but to sustain it, you needed something to keep people entertained, to keep people up at night, to keep people strong together.
One year later, many of the revolution's goals remain unmet. The sit-in ended in a bloody massacre, and violence and impunity continue in Sudan. Still, Sudanese people today enjoy far greater freedom to express themselves than before the revolution, including the freedom to play live music. So El-Beti says Sudan's musicians will keep performing.
Because we really believe in the power of music. You know, politically, it's been chaos. Been very difficult, you know, economically, by all means. But people are still out there, you know, they're still working hard to like make more music, and you know, we have to push through, and it's happening, you know. There's no stopping us, I think, at this point.
Sudan's revolutionary soundtrack plays on. All songs in this story were recorded live at the revolution in 2019. Jason Patinkin for VOA News, Washington.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. And on behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington, thanking you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.